Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We thank you for being here this morning. We have one case to be argued at 9 o'clock, and I understand that both attorneys are present. Before we begin, I'll introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief of the Court. Before the attorneys begin their arguments, will you please call the case?
The court will now call number 02-24-374-CP, Allied Universal Security Services versus Farley. May it please the court. Mr. Landon Francois will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Paul Wineski will argue for the appellant.
Mr. Francois?
If I may, Your Honor. I need to apologize to y'all. The reason we're starting just a little bit late today is me. So you guys were timely. I don't have a good excuse for it, and I just wish to apologize for that. Thank you.
Probably give us a little bit more time to get settled in here.
You're very gracious. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The parties agree that the central issue in this case is whether Allied owed a tort duty to protect Mr. Farley from crime. The answer is no. While I plan to focus argument today on the two rendition points raised in our briefing, I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have. So, the two rendition points we raised. First, the Allied Trinity contract did not impose a tort duty on Allied to prevent third-party criminal acts. And second, even assuming a tort duty did exist, there was legally insufficient evidence at trial of proximate cause. Beginning with the first issue, duty. The top line is, the no duty rule controls this case.
At what point in time did you specially accept to the pleadings of the plaintiffs asserting that? Giving them an opportunity to replead.
Your Honor, I don't recall that a special exception was ever filed. However, both pre-trial and during trial, there were numerous opportunities in which Allied pointed out that this contract does not create a legal duty, that negligence is not the proper cause of action, move for directed verdict on that basis, and move for a JNOV on that basis. And at no point in time did the plaintiff ever amend or add new causes of action against other parties.
Was there any objection to that, to a negligent activity theory of liability, or even just a negligence theory of liability? On that basis during the presentation of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. There was both a pretrial motion, I believe it was.
Okay, was it a dispositive motion or was it a motion in limine?
I believe it was a 166G, actually, a legal motion for the court to dispose of the contractual issue. Then during trial, throughout, there were various objections to the contract creating a duty. Then there was a directed verdict at the close of plaintiff's case as to the negligence theory that there was no duty stated. There was an objection at the charge conference to the submission of general negligence on the basis that no duty was stated because, again, this is purely a contractual relationship. We again stated it in our JNOV post-trial, and then we obviously noted it on appeal. But I think either way, at this point in the case, Appley's briefing specifically states that this is a pure ordinary negligence case on the basis of a failure to comply with contractual duties, that they did not plead or prove a premises liability theory, a special relationship theory, or
Let's talk about a special relationship. You define a special relationship in your brief as legal relationships, guardianships, etc. But you can also create a special relationship by contract, such as those for professional malpractice. So why shouldn't a professional security company here be held to that type of standard?
You can create a special relationship through contract. Again, that still is a tort claim that would require to be pleaded. However, there is no special relationship between a security company and the public generally. And secondly, when
that kind of seems contradictory to Mayer, doesn't it? It says that talking about this Bonshoff case out of Eastland confirms that security companies owe no generalized tort duty to the victim of third-party criminal acts beyond the governing contract terms. So that suggests the contract can create a duty of care to a third party.
And, Your Honor, specifically, and Mayor, the issue there was whether or not the security company exercised control over the premises in where a premises liability claim could exist.
Was there any dispute here that Allied controlled the premises under the circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. There was substantial dispute. For example, the testimony at trial from both Allied and Trinity Metro was that Trinity Metro, who was the governing entity, controlled the number of hours that Allied provided security services. It controlled how many people it would hire at any given time to provide security. It dictated how Allied was supposed to go about its security. And moreover, at this point...
Okay, well, if that's true, then was there not a contractual provision that there would be somebody on the platform to meet the trains when they got in, and there was nobody on the platform to meet this particular train?
Your Honor, there were contractual provisions about where about the placement of an unarmed security officer who had a number of duties. That is correct, yes. However, the fact that whether he was on the platform to meet this particular train or not, I can discuss this a little bit later, but there's no evidence that that was the proximate cause of this assault. But regardless, even if the contract states a duty, there is no general duty for Allied or anybody to provide security services. Allied, absent this contract, had no tort duty to have a security guard on that platform. And this is a tort case. This is a general negligence case.
Well, let me understand what you're saying. If the contract said that there was supposed to be a transit officer attached at the hip to any conductor on the train, would you still argue you had no duty, because not worried about third-party beneficiary, but would you still argue you had no duty because the contractor, the conductor, was not in privity with the security company?
No, Your Honor, that's not the basis of the argument. The basis of the argument is that the general rule in Texas is there is no duty to prevent third-party criminal acts. A contract that provides for specific security operations does not create that tort duty. That has never been recognized in Texas. There are limited exceptions to the no-duty rule. That's Timberwalk, special relationship, and negligent undertaking. What you're describing could, under certain circumstances, perhaps give rise to a special relationship claim. If somebody was in privity, or they perhaps a negligent undertaking claim, if they did rely on that provision of security. But
did not Del Lago specifically recognize negligent activity as a premises issue with regard to security? Your opening brief cites Del Lago once and doesn't even discuss it, even though it's an extensive discussion of the interaction of the duties of a premises owner occupier with regard to their patrons.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, again, Del Lago is a premises liability case, and this is not a premises liability case. That is the key difference. This is a negligent activity case. Del Lago specifically states...
Negligent activity is a theory under premises.
No, Your Honor, because Del Lago is a nonfeasance case. This is a malfeasance case, effectively. The United Scaffolding from the Supreme Court instructs us that a recovery in negligence does not support a premises liability theory, and vice versa. They are mutually...
Does that case even discuss Timberwalk or Del Lago?
It's not a Timberwalk case, but Timberwalk is a premises liability theory.
Well, Timberwalk is a premises liability case because it's talking about a general duty to the public. But when there is a specific duty to a patron or to a commercial customer, or to an employee, that's a different animal. And Del Lago seems to suggest that, in fact, Trinity had a duty to those people riding the trains and coming onto their premises for that purpose and leaving their premises for that purpose. Would you not agree that there was a duty to protect their patrons as they were ingressing and egressing?
Your Honor, I actually completely agree with that. The issue here is that Allied is not Trinity. Allied is not an arm of Trinity.
But Allied was hired specifically by Trinity to comply with its common law duty with regard to its premises under Del Lago.
That is correct. And if Trinity thought that Allied failed to comply with the terms of its contract, Trinity could bring a breach of contract suit against Allied.
And could hold Trinity, actually, Mr. Farley could hold Trinity vicariously liable for any negligence of Allied under the circumstances, because Allied was the agent by which Trinity was supposedly complying or not complying with its general duty to its patrons to protect them.
Under these specific circumstances, Allied was an independent contractor, so I'm not sure if vicarious liability would be a recoverable element. However, Mr. Farley did not sue Trinity. He never sued the premises owner for this Timberwalk case, and that is the fundamental difference between this and Del Lago. Del Lago is the owner of the premises. They also had security on site, but they were not sued.
So you're telling me that if Mr. Hansbrough had been removed from the premises by Mr. Pena and had been done so roughly in some way, shape, or form, okay, and Mr. Hansbrough was the one who, in fact, had suffered injury, that because Allied was an independent contractor, that under these circumstances, Allied didn't have a duty with regard to the removal?
So I think there's two questions in there, Your Honor. I'll take them in turn. As far as, for example, if Allied had been negligent in the performance of its contractual duties, had engaged in a negligent activity, let's say they were patrolling in a patrol vehicle and hit somebody. Let's say they roughly removed somebody from a platform. That would state a cause of action against Allied. That duty does not disappear. And that's the difference between this case and a Scharenbeck case. The Texas Supreme Court in Delaney and Wolf Hollow specifically stated that if you are performing contractual obligations and you commit a negligent act based on your ordinary duty of care, that states a negligence claim. The difference here is that there is no duty of care, generally, to the public to prevent criminal acts. The only way that Allied ever had such a duty was under contract.
Mr. Farley's not a member of the general public. Mr. Farley's an employee he's a contractor, which is specifically identified as a third-party beneficiary under your contract. And in fact, your contract specifically says that you're supposed to be dealing with trespassers and trespassers who may assault contractors such as Farley. So you're suggesting that because that's purely a contractual duty, that somehow you don't get, you don't have any liability for in effect breaching your contract with regard to Mr. Farley, when the contract that you're under specifically contemplates the very thing that happened here?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, on the third-party beneficiary, Mr. Farley is not named as a third-party beneficiary. That's not how the contract is operated. He may be an incidental.
He's a contractor, is he not?
He is a contractor.
He's a contractor, and contractor is used specifically in your contract with Trinity with regard to the purpose and what the duties are.
Yes, Your Honor.
And trespassers are specifically mentioned, is it not?
Both of those things
are
true.
And you're supposed to be providing protection to customers and employees and contractors vis-a-vis assaults potentially from trespassers. That's exactly this case.
I will not disagree that those things are stated in the contract. However,
so somehow because it's simply in the contract, he does, and you breached the contract under the circumstances, y'all are exempt from any kind of liability for that?
Two responses, Your Honor. The first response is that as far as whether a breach occurred, that was not a finding by the jury. The jury did not find that a breach of the contract occurred. The jury merely rendered an ordinary negligence finding against Allied. And that's kind of the issue here, is that if a claim is brought as a breach of contract, the jury can identify if a contractual provision was violated. The second response, Your Honor, is that
they had that contract in front of them, though, for purposes of determining what the standard of care for your people were, right?
I believe that the issue is that it was mixed at trial as to what the standard of care was. They did have the contract.
But that was
in front of
them, though. Evidence that the standard of care for your client was to make sure that contractors were protected from trespassers and potential assaults from trespassers while they were doing their work.
I believe there was some testimony to that effect, Your Honor. But, and this brings me back to my second response to your question, the general no-duty rule has limited exceptions. The Texas Supreme Court has said as much. Entering into a contract is not one of them. And the Texas Supreme Court has expressly declined to recognize cases like Scharenbeck, which is the primary tort during a contract case, for exactly this. I direct the court to Wolf Hollow.
We've had Montgomery Ward since 1947.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do not disagree with the application of Montgomery Ward. The issue here is that this is not a negligent activity case. Montgomery Ward, Chapman Custom Homes, which applied Montgomery Ward, they both make it clear that those are negligent activity cases where you breach a pre-existing duty independent of the contract. And again, this court, I direct you to Delaney and Wolf Hollow. Wolf Hollow was
Delaney said the nature of the injury most often determines which duty or duties are breached. When the only loss or damage is to the subject matter of the contract, the plaintiff's action is ordinarily on the contract. So it's a little broader principle than whether or not it's just a pre-existing tort duty, isn't it?
That is correct. It also encompasses the economic loss rule. However, as the Supreme Court in Chapman Custom Homes pointed out, there are two factors that you look at. The economic loss rule is one. So if you breach a duty of tort duty and then you cause only economic losses, there's no negligence claim. But the second is that the duty must arise independent of the contract, which means that if you have to look at the contract, and Wolf Hollow explains this in detail, if your claim is essentially the gist of your claim is that somebody did not comply with their contractual obligations, you have not stated a tort claim. You have stated a breach of contract claim. And that's where the no duty rule comes in here. The difference with cases like Gator Gone, Montgomery Ward, and Chapman is that you have a pre-existing duty of care to not burn down houses, to not flood houses, but there is no pre-existing duty of care for Allied to provide specific security services. And just very briefly, since I only have about 20 seconds left, on proximate cause, your honors have identified both the transit officer and Mr. Pena on the platform. I'll take them in turn. Transit officer, Trinity Metro contracted for 111 hours of transit officer. That was not for a specific train. That was for all six trains. There was only one transit officer at any time that would rotate among trains. The mere fact that one was not present at this time is not sufficient evidence of proximate cause. I'll address the other issue in rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. When I was reviewing the briefing in this case and the legal authorities, I realized, that I could have stated our position in this case with a great deal more nuance than I did in my appellee's brief. So if the court's permission, I'd like to state it now. Yes, there is a contract between Allied and Trinity for Allied to provide security services. And that contract specifically states they will provide protection of employees and contractors from assaults. That is a contract claim that I don't think Mr. Farley had the standing to enforce. But under Schoenbeck, under Chapman Custom Homes, because of that contract, Texas common law implies a duty in tort to perform that contract with the care and skill that a reasonably prudent security company would under the circumstances presented, or same or similar circumstances. That is the duty that we pled and proved that was breached in this case and that caused damage to Mr. Farley in terms of grievous personal injuries.
Was the duty that you pled and that was not specially accepted to a general duty to the public, or was it a duty that you in your pleading made clear was associated with the contractual obligations of Allied to provide security under the circumstances?
I reviewed that petition yesterday, Your Honor, and it could have been a bit more clear in that regard, but Texas, of course, is a notice pleading state. But yes, that is
the duty. Does your pleading mention the contract between Allied and Trinity Metro?
I believe it did, Your Honor, but I can't swear to it one way or the
okay,
other.
Is the duty alleged predicated on a reasonable performance of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor. That was the case that we tried to the jury.
Well, is that what you pled?
No, I think the pleading was a bit more general. Okay. And it could have been subject to special exceptions, and they were not filed if they wanted more specificity. But the negligent performance of a contract that proximately injures a non-contracting party's property or person states a negligence claim. So said the Texas Supreme Court in 2014 in Chapman Custom Homes. And that is the theory upon which that case was tried and upon which the jury rendered their answer. I would also like to address the fact that, yes, you could certainly find a special relationship under the contract, because the contract specifically says it's for the protection of employees and contractors from trespassers and assaults, as you pointed
out.
Well,
your client's not actually a contracting party.
No, we are not parties to that contract.
We're really talking about a third-party beneficiary situation.
Yes, and or the independent tort duty that was recognized first in Schoenbeck and has continued to be recognized by the Texas Supreme Court. It's not a case where it's either or. there can be liability in both contract and tort under the proper circumstances, as were presented in Scharnbeck and...
Well, if somebody had been attacked out on the parking lot, okay, and Mr. Pena, instead of being in the parking lot, was actually up on the platform, all right, there would be no general duty unless, in fact, there was, in fact, a showing under Timberwalk that that particular neighborhood had a particular proclivity for criminal activity of that type of nature, and therefore there was a occupier owner of the premises duty with regard to people that were invited onto the property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So under those circumstances, there wouldn't be a general duty to the public.
No, and we have, it's never been our position that Allied owned a general duty or a duty to the general public. They owed a duty to the persons or classes of people that were named in their contract. And Mr. Farley clearly falls within that class of persons.
And tell me why the failure to provide a security officer was the proximate cause of Mr. Farley's injury.
Well, we had expert testimony that had that security program been followed as it was laid out, that this assault would not have happened. Let's define terms here. Security officers are the unarmed security officers.
They're supposed to be on the platform when the train comes in.
And our theory was, and is, that had Mr. Pena been on the platform when Mr. Hansborough approached the train, that Mr. Hansborough would have either been deterred by the presence of a uniformed security officer, or that the officer would have spotted Mr. Hansborough, determined that he had no business being there, and removed him from the platform.
And that's an objective standard, because people who do this kind of thing sometimes are not subjectively rational with regard to what they will and will not be deterred from. Is that correct?
That is true, Your Honor. And our expert admitted, you know, crimes do happen even with a great security program in place.
And you don't have to have expert testimony, because in DeLago, the court specifically said there was lay testimony with regard to security could have avoided under the circumstances.
Exactly.
And that's the specific language of the Supreme Court.
Yes, it is. And that is the language that we are relying upon. And let me just hit one point briefly here. Counsel has repeatedly said, well, these are premises liability cases that he's relying on, and that this is not a premises liability case, which is true. But the principles of negligence enunciated in those premises liability cases, we believe, apply equally to an ordinary negligence case, which is what we brought and what we tried in this case.
Let me get back to the transit officer. His point is that there were only a certain number of hours authorized under the contract for transit officer. Basically, Allied got to decide when a transit officer would be on a train. How did they fail in their, how did they breach their duty of ordinary care under those circumstances?
Well, I can't remember whether it's the contract or the post orders, but there are orders in place that say no station shall be unattended. Now, whose problem is that to make sure that those stations are attended? It's Allied's. They're the ones that decide when the officers are going to ride which trains. And the fact that they are not being paid enough by Trinity to employ a sufficient number of officers to have an officer on every train all day, every day, is a matter of economics, not legal duty. It was a choice that was made.
It's a matter of what the contract specifies, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And those were...
So if the contract defines the duty, and they're given the discretion as to how to man these trains, because Trinity hasn't provided enough hours for the trains to be manned 24/7, don't you have a problem with respect to the breach of duty claim with respect to the transit officer?
Your Honor, it's simply our position that had a transit officer been on that train with Mr. Farley, the attack would not have occurred.
I understand that, but the question is whether or not under the terms of the contract there was a requirement that a transit officer be on that train.
There was not a requirement that a transit officer be on every train all the time. No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
You familiar with the case Lincoln Property Company versus DeShazo? I am, because I was in therapy and still am in therapy because of that case. It's an en banc decision of this court dealing with a fight outside of a bar in South Fort Worth.
And it was argued by me on behalf of Lincoln Property that, in fact, because this was a single punch case, that the bar owner and the property owner didn't have the opportunity to intervene, as would be suggested as being the duty under Jack in the Box versus Eastep, and maybe the East Texas Theaters versus Rutledge case, and maybe Wolkowiak thrown in. That was rejected by the en banc court in that regard, with regard to the causation argument. And the entire theory of liability was there weren't enough guards out in the parking lot to prevent the attack that in fact occurred here. So under those circumstances, how would that apply here?
Well, I think that would apply equally, Your Honor. The contract required protection of employees, and the employees were not protected because there were not a sufficient number of transit officers in particular supplied to be with the conductor on the train conducting their sweeps at when docked at the TNP and waiting to go back to the Fort Worth Central Station.
Okay, but that, and this is where we get into this holding the property owner to vicariously liable, okay, for the acts and omissions of their agents, versus, so the decision about how many guards was actually Lincoln Property's decision to make under the circumstances. So it's almost where Justice Basil's going, which is, since Trinity is placing the limitations on what is going on, how do you get to the point where there should have been more provided by Allied, okay, if in fact they're running up against restrictions from Trinity? And was there any pleading of those restrictions as an affirmative defense or anything of that nature by Allied?
Not to my recollection, but I don't quote me on that.
We do have somebody out in the parking lot who also included platform duties under the circumstances, and the being next to a conductor was not limited to the transit officers, was it, or was it under the contract?
Under the contract, that was one of the duties of the transit officers in particular. The security officer was required to be on the platform when the train arrived and to check in with the conductor to see if there had been any issues on the train.
Okay, so there's reference in the record to Mr. Hansborough as being a trespasser. Did that mean he had not purchased a ticket? Was he on the premises in a trespass? He was not an invitee. He was in fact a trespasser.
He was in fact a trespasser. He turned out to be a homeless person who did not have a ticket for the train. There was testimony, I believe, from Mr. Farley that homeless people would often get on the train while it was on the layover at the TNP station, excuse me, because the train had air conditioning, they had restrooms, they had power plugs for phones.
Is there any testimony about how long after the train arrived that Mr. Hansborough got on the train?
No, Your Honor. That could not be determined. We only know the attack occurred between 10 and 15 minutes after the train arrived at the TNP station. In terms of causation, of course, the Werner Enterprises case came out at the end of June of this year after my briefing was completed, and emphasized more strongly the substantial factor aspect of proximate cause. And that, to be honest, troubles, because that looks like the Supreme Court is walking down a road to being more and more strict in these cases. And what I would like to call the court's attention to is the very well-written dissent authored by Justice Bland. Werner was a 5-3 decision, and Justice Bland wrote the dissenting opinion. And among other things, she pointed to the Texas Proportionate Responsibility Statute to see what the legislature had determined was appropriate to consider imposing liability upon a defendant. And her statement is, the Texas statute governing proportionate responsibility requires a fact finder to evaluate the conduct of any party who causes or contributes to the injury of the plaintiffs in any way, in quotes. And then she quotes the statute. The trier of fact.
Contributes is a distinct term from cause.
I'm sorry?
Contribute is a distinct term from cause, and that's been in the tort reform since 1987. And so, but nobody's ever actually held, and apparently in Werner, the Supreme Court did not hold, that the legislature changed proximate cause by defining a percentage of responsibility in that manner.
No, they haven't, Your Honor. However, I do think, as Justice Bland obviously thought with her two colleagues, that it is significant that in writing the statute, the legislature talks of each person's causing or contributing to cause in any way the harm for which recovery and damages is sought, whether by negligent act or omission. And to me, it looks like the Texas Supreme Court is moving very far past that standard. Justice Bland pointed out that in Neighbors Well Service versus Romero, we held that the term in any way is expansive and can mean only what it says. There are no restrictions on assigning responsibility, in this case to a plaintiff, as long as it can be shown the plaintiff's conduct caused or contributed to his personal injury or death.
But those contributors aren't required to suffer a judgment against them. They're just simply there to offset the judgment amount, the damages amount.
Good point, Your Honor.
Is Romero the seatbelt case?
Yes.
Okay. So that was in the context of
contributing to the severity of the injuries by
the court, where the court was deciding to extend the failure to use a seatbelt because it was not an occurrence-causing event, but was an injury-causing event.
Yes, Your Honor.
They expanded that
basically
rule.
Basically, abolished the rule that you can't refer to not wearing seatbelts as a contributing factor to the plaintiff's injuries. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I take it your position with regard to this argument, well, who bore the burden with regard to the presentation of Hansborough's responsibility under the circumstances? Did your client bear any burden of demonstrating that Hansborough was negligent or assaultive or anything of that nature?
Well, no, Your Honor, we weren't. That would be an affirmative defense.
Okay, so if that's the burden, then under what was actually offered by Allied with regard to how that was going to be presented?
Allied simply proceeded on a no-duty theory during the whole case.
Okay. So I think somewhere in your briefing you indicate that Allied at one point in time had an assault theory of liability that they had offered to the trial court and then apparently abandoned that at trial.
Yes, Your Honor, and that would have made this case a whole lot easier to understand. Yes, in Allied's proposed charge to the court, they had a question, number two, which specifically was an assault question. Did Jerry and Marcus Hansborough commit an assault? Gave the definition of assault right out of the pattern jury charges. Had that question been submitted along with the negligence question, then with some appropriate wording, the court could have fashioned an apportionment question.
Well, percentage of responsibility, getting back to contribute, the Supreme Court's made it clear, and the legislature has too, that you can now compare intentional tort conduct that causes an injury with negligent activity that causes.
And that could have been done in this case.
Okay, but that was not done here. So the question becomes, since the burden here is a sterner burden on the part of Allied, okay, is evidence of negligence is evidence of an intentional assault any evidence of negligence?
No, Your Honor, it is not. The two are mutually exclusive. The cases have been very clear on that. There is no such thing as negligence being a lesser included offense of assault as asserted in Allied's brief. They're just two different things. And I believe had the assault question been included and answered one way or the other, then I think the jury apportionment would have been different. But
so
they were
the jury
only
had the jury found no as to assault, then you'd be agreeing that this would be reversible under the circumstances.
No, I would not, Your Honor.
Well, that would be
if there had been an assault question, you would agree that some percentage of responsibility should have been assigned to Mr. Hansborough. Is that your argument?
My argument is that it would have been allowed. Some percentage would have been allowed to be assigned to Mr. Hansborough. But
and
the jury was not asked to apportion.
They his conduct in the wrong cubbyhole on the basis of negligence. Therefore, the jury's answer to question number two, assigning the percentage of responsibility, is correct.
Yes, Your Honor, because they were only asked to assign responsibility for negligent conduct as defined in the charge, which, again, is right out of the pattern jury charges. And they weren't asked to assign responsibility for intentional conduct, which is what an assault is.
So, in other words, there under that distinction and under Sterner, there's no evidence that the jury should have answered yes, and there's not conclusive evidence that, in fact, Hansborough was negligent under the circumstances.
There is no evidence that Hansborough was negligent. Hansborough was intentional. He did not fail to do what a person of ordinary reasonable prudence would have done, and he did not do that which a person of ordinary prudence would not have done. He committed an intentional assault. I have 26 seconds left, and I will give that time back to the court.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to just begin briefly where Appley ended. So on this assault versus negligence, we agree in our briefing that assault probably should have been submitted. It would have been, but we also think that Hansborough need not have been submitted on a liability theory. I think the evidence was conclusive. We could have skipped straight to proportionate responsibility on him. Regardless, I think that it's incorrect that.
Do you have any authority whatsoever for submitting a proportionate responsibility provision unless there's a stipulation?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, actually
there was no stipulation, was there?
Well, the motion to designate a responsible third party was actually unopposed. There was not. It was both parties agreed to submit Hansborough as a responsible third party.
But you still have to have a theory of liability based upon that.
Your Honor, that's correct.
Based upon a responsible third party, you still have to have a theory of liability.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't actually think that it's a valuable effort to spend more time on that. I think that actually highlights the main issue in this case, which is submitting the wrong theory. Because in the same way that, as they
that
say-
That wasn't their burden to submit that theory.
Understandable,
but it was- your responsible third party motion, was it not?
Your Honor, it was, but it was their burden to submit a negligence theory against Allied, and they did not. They did not submit a tort duty.
Well, they submitted a negligence theory. You're just saying it wasn't the correct one.
In the exact same way that evidence of assault is not evidence of negligence, evidence of a breach of contract is not evidence of tort liability under negligence. And I'd like to direct this court back to the Supreme Court's holding on this. And El Paso v. Wolf Hollow specifically deals with this exact same issue. In that, there's a tripartite relationship. There's El Paso, who provides Wolf Hollow with gas. El Paso sources the gas from Enterprise, and then Wolf Hollow sued Enterprise for negligence, saying you failed to comply with your contractual duties and you injured us as a result. The Supreme Court said no, because they had no duty under pre-existing the contract to supply any quality of gas whatsoever. That's the exact same scenario here. Allied had no duty, absent the contract, to be on the platform, to have transit officers. If they were just some person standing around, they had no duty to do anything. And so what Wolf Hollow says is that if you have to look to the terms of the contract to determine whether a breach occurred, it states a contract claim, not a tort claim. And that's the difference between Scharenbeck and Chapman Homes and this case and Wolf Hollow. And that's the exact same logic that was applied in Delaney. The issue, and it's very clear if you read the concurrence, Justice Gonzalez's concurrence in Delaney specifically goes through and says, if the gist of your claim is somebody failed to comply with contractual obligations, you do not state a tort claim. You have to have a pre-existing duty of care. And under the general no-duty rule, that only exists under the three circumstances that we outlined and which they have disclaimed. They did not bring a premises Timberwalk case. Allied was not the property owner. Trinity Metro was. And that brings us to the other issues. Justice Birdwell.
Counsel, you've got Exxon Corporation versus Tidwell sitting out there where the Supreme Court of the state of Texas has held that a security issue at a gas station is a hybrid premises and agency argument.
That was very specific to the franchisee requirements of gas stations.
I understand that a franchisee is a contract, is it not?
It is, but as the Court of Appeals and Mayor, in looking at Exxon v. Con, I believe it was, or Shell v. Con, which was an offshoot of the Exxon case, they specifically said that doesn't apply to the general premises liability hiring a contractor. That's specifically a franchisor-franchisee relationship issue.
But this isn't a case of Mr. Farley wandering onto the premises and being attacked. This is, he's where he's supposed to be. He's at least as much as a patron under Del Lago.
Absolutely, and he should have sued, like in Del Lago, Trinity Metro, not Allied. And then if Trinity Metro says, well, we hired this for Allied to provide the contract, they can sue Allied.
The courts have long held that you can sue either the master or the servant under the circumstances, and I know you're going to get into the independent contractor situation, but that is a sticky wicket right now because the Supreme Court's all over the place. You've got the Fifth Club, Inc. versus Rodriguez saying that, well, independent contractor, because they get to determine, you know, how they're going to crush the guy's skull against the wall. Therefore, the club owner doesn't have any liability there. But then,
Your Honor, I totally understand. I have very limited time, so just to address that very quickly, under either theory, as Del Lago itself states, it is a premises case. This is not. This is a ordinary negligent activity case, but in his briefing he admits Allied didn't do anything negligent. They didn't engage in something that caused Farley's injuries. Their entire case is premised on a failure to comply with the contract. And briefly, I just want to address Justice Basil's question. May I finish this statement?
Yes.
You asked opposing counsel whether or not there was any evidence how long the train was parked. It's incorrect that there wasn't. Farley himself testified that he was there for 20 minutes prior to when the attack occurred. So even had Pena met the train at the platform when it arrived, he would have departed long before the assault actually took place. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted, and we appreciate your arguments. They've been very helpful to us. You are now free to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
All rise.